This is the Untitled Car Show with your host for the evening, Ike.
Billy, it's your day. It's what you have practiced for.
And Proc.
Hey, buddy, roll your window down so I can ask you about your dead friend.
We hope you thoroughly enjoy the show. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Ike with the Untitled Cars Show. I'm here today. I'm going to be all by myself, but we have a special guest calling in. It's going to be Bob Lutz. He is the author of Icons and Idiots, a straight talk on leadership. It's a former CEO of General Motors, or vice chairman of General Motors, my mistake. He's worked in Ford, General Motors, Chrysler's, and BMW over the last half century. Most recently with GM. So we're going to be asking him a few questions about the book, and we're going to ask him a few questions about his career in the automotive industry and get a couple of car guy questions in there while we're at it. So we're going to be right back when Bob calls in. All right, welcome back to the show. As promised, we have Bob Lutz. He is the author of Icons and Idiots, Straight Talk on Leadership. Bob, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. Thank you very much. Hope this is true for you.
Yep. Same was true with me. Bob, I read through the book, and I just want to give you a couple quick bits of praise to it. The book talks about leadership in America and the world in general, and the decline of or the rise of political correctness, I guess. I think the book serves well if you are a leader or serve under someone, but as a new parent reading through the book, especially some of the stories like the Clorox story with the Marines, it kind of gives you a insight in how to prepare even raising children in the future and getting them to do what you need them to do, even if it doesn't make sense to them.
So. Yeah.
I love in the book, too, you talk about how most of the leaders you served under were not average Joes, and you even admit to yourself, as a child, to have what would now be called ADD and being a slow learner and whatnot, and how that kind of forced you to down a path that took you to, the pinnacle of industry where you're at now. So it's a great book. It's a great read. And for anyone out there who hasn't read it, I think you need to go pick it up and read it because it's very hard to put down.
Well, thank you. I designed my books to be educational, but I want them to be educational while being entertaining.
Yeah, it's very entertaining. It's got each chapter, each leader has one or two great stories that will have you laughing out loud.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad. That's the purpose of the book. If people learn something, I'm happy, but I basically want them to be entertained.
Yeah. What I love about the book, too, is it's very even-handed with the way you approach all these people you used to work with and work under. It could have easily turned into this guy was crazy and was an awful leader and whatnot. And you take a very even-handed approach to all the people you worked with. And I just find that, impressive. Is there a reason you didn't want it to turn into a smear campaign of all your past leaders?
Well, some people have told me that, some people who know some of these individuals tell me I was a little easy on them. For instance, they say I was a little easy on Red Poling. Mm-hmm. But, and while that the former chairman of Ford, who, just was bizarre in his, frequently in his decision making and his demeanor and the way he treated people. But, you can't just look at it through the perspective of, did I enjoy working with this person? Did I have a good relationship with him? You have to basically do what the shareholders do, which is judge him by his results. Did he or she move the company forward or not? And if the answer is yes, they did a good job creating shareholder value, then the fact that they may have had some major idiosyncrasies that were talked about at the lunchroom and so forth, it really doesn't matter.
That's one of the things I like about the book, too, is you even have on the back of the book, where you number value, as if we were, shareholders and give good leaders, bad leaders. And it's very, like concise at the back of the book about like who was better and who was worse and all that. So that was.
Yeah. Oh, you mean the sort of summary with the rating system?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, of course, that's very arbitrary. It's somewhat arbitrary, the measurement criteria you use, and then especially the weighting system. I mean, I've had a lot of people tell me, yes, that's very clever, I like your rating system, but for leaders, I don't think you rated creativity important enough. That would be true, and different people would come up with different weightings. But fundamentally, I think everybody agrees that those are the traits that make good leaders, and while the weightings of the individual characteristics are, you know, obviously subjective and somewhat debatable, but all in all, people thought the rating system was fair, except, like you said, and like I said earlier, there were some people who also knew some of the people and worked under them, and who thought I was a little generous.
Yeah, from some of the stories, and you can kind of pick up, you work for some rather, like, cuckoo, I guess would be the best word to put it, or idiosyncratic leaders. But that doesn't make them, like you said, bad leaders, which I think is, like, what you get across in the book. One of the stories I have to ask you about from the book, though, is after you left BMW, you said you started having dinners with, and I'm going to mess up this name, but Eberhard von Kuhnheim.
Eberhard von Kuhnheim.
Kuhnheim.
The longest serving automobile executive ever.
Yeah.
When I became chairman of Ford of Europe, he was in London on business, and he called me up and asked if we could have dinner, and I said, sure. He was highly complimentary over what I had done years before at BMW. In fact, he actually credited me with saving the company, even though some of the things I had done at the time put me in conflict with him. So I thought he was very fair in reassessing the past. And he said, you know, I think the reason we didn't get along was we were both very young. Mm-hmm. And we were both very ambitious, and he says, I probably didn't have enough tolerance for somebody who is wired differently from me. And I said, yeah, and I was probably at times disrespectful. But we actually had a very good relationship after I left the company.
Yeah,
not so good while I was in the company.
Yeah, the book gets that across. I just can't imagine, like, that meeting, like, of the two of you immediately afterwards, like, not just being the most awkward thing in the world for at least a little bit.
Yeah.
It was one of those, like, you helped create the 3.0 CSL while you were there at BMW, and the Oberto, or the turbo spelled backwards, BMW 2002 while you were there, and all the naming structure, like the 3 Series, 5 Series, 7 Series, was all underneath, you know, your tenure there, I guess is the way to put it. And you oversaw a lot of projects in the car community during your tenure with Chrysler and whatnot. What do you think was your favorite car project over your, you know, lifetime in the industry?
The greatest what?
The car you enjoyed the design process and were happiest with the outcome.
Oh, I see. You know, sort of the most meaningful vehicle in my career.
Yeah.
I'd have to say it was the Chevrolet Volt, because it was a radical departure from anything that any automobile company had done before.
Mm-hmm.
It required General Motors to invent a lot of technology that had not yet been invented by anybody else. And that's always hard to do in a big company, because I think big companies, by and large, like to follow. They like to adopt a similar solution to one that someone else has already proven. And they do not, generally don't like the risk that comes from having to invent something themselves. And of course, the Chevy Volt was exactly something that nobody else had done before. Mm-hmm. Nobody else had ever used lithium-ion batteries. Automotive-grade lithium-ion batteries didn't even exist when we started the Volt. So that was a very exciting project that basically stretched the capability of a company like General Motors. Mm-hmm. And it was also, there were a lot of naysayers, including our number one Japanese competitor, Toyota, who had actually called press conferences to point out to the global media that what General Motors was announcing here was a public relations stunt, and that a lithium-ion powered electric car or plug-in hybrid would never see the light of day. And of course, if it were feasible, Toyota would have already done it, because everybody knew that they were the technological leader in battery power and so forth. So, and you know, at the time, General Motors' credibility wasn't all that high. And when journalists were told by GM, we're going to do it, and then Toyota said, don't listen to that, they can't do it. Back in those days, it was like, whom do you believe? And most of them elected to believe Toyota. So it was a tremendously satisfying program when the car finally hit the road and was named Car of the Year in the United States by U.S. journalists, and was also named Car of the Year in Europe, which was the first time that's ever happened.
Yeah.
And it did a lot towards reestablishing GM as a credible automobile company. So I think that was, have I worked on cars that were faster and more visceral? And so, yes, of course.
Yeah.
But all in all, I have to say the Chevy Volt is the one that I look back on with the most satisfaction.
Well, it's nice to have that car that not only works great, I've driven one, they drive really good and they handle fairly decently for an electric car, but to have the extra little bit of oomph for being in, you know, basically started a new industry. I mean, when you have BMW chasing GM's tail with their all new electric cars that are coming out, are basically similar to the Volt in their their design layout with an engine and electric drivetrain. You know, you got to feel good about that. And you get to stick it to Toyota by saying, oh, you didn't think we could do this? And then just jabbing them with that. Like, that's one of the things that you seem to have an uncanny knack for, is predicting trends in the automotive industry. You said electrification of the automobile is inevitable. I mean, that's something that we're seeing now. You foresaw the market for, like, you know, cars like the Pontiac G8 and the Camaro coming back to the U.S. What do you think is the next big trend beyond this, if you even think we're beyond
this? Well, without question, you know, electrification is stalled a little bit now because of the low price of fuel.
Yeah.
But that's just a momentary thing. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, cars will be electric, but it requires more advances in the battery field, which will be coming in the next 5 or 6 years,
mm-hmm.
No question about it. And once you have, say, a lithium-ion or similar battery with a range of 400 miles, then there's absolutely no reason to have an internal combustion engine, because, you know, nobody's going to drive more than 400 miles a day anyway. So then there's also no question that cars of the future will be fully autonomous.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be standardized little driving modules which you will call to your home, and then you program in a destination. The thing takes you to the freeway. Once on the freeway, it merges into a high-speed train of other modules like yours,
mm-hmm.
and the whole thing moves at about 120, 150 miles an hour. So it actually becomes the fusion of mass transportation and individual transportation. Then when it leaves freeway, your module will go into deceleration lane. It'll go out the exit. It'll take you to your final destination. Then you leave it. You'll be billed for the mileage you used, and the module goes off and parks itself. And this, of course, is a much more efficient use of the transportation grid than everybody having their own car, which they only use a tiny fraction of the time. And we're seeing the transition to this. Various things are pointing in that direction. Uber is one, which is basically the same thought of individual on-demand transportation models, except here there's still human drivers and conventional cars. Car sharing is another one that tries to enhance the efficiency of the grid by making a better use of the vehicles that are out there. And all these things, there'll be a phase where cars will be autonomous on the freeway, but not off freeway. And that's actually here now.
Yeah.
That'll be followed by cars that are autonomous everywhere. And the first generation of those may well be conventionally powered. In other words, fossil fuel and internal combustion engines.
Yeah.
But that will all transition to electric drive. Now, you know, I may not see it. You may. I don't know how old you are. It's a couple of decades away.
Yeah. I agree with cars you.
Will,
What? I'm sorry.
Yeah, cars will be relegated. Just the same thing that happened to the horse. They'll be relegated off-highway, and they'll exist in automotive country clubs and off-road venues and so forth. And people will have, they'll have their cars, but they can only have them on privately owned property. And road use is strictly for the autonomous modules. And what I really haven't figured out is what happens to the premium brands in a situation like that. Since you don't own your own module, how do you have a Mercedes-Benz BMW module if on the highway it doesn't go any faster? It doesn't do anything that the others don't do because they're going to be standardized anyway. So that kind of sets up some interesting questions.
That's fascinating. Maybe just better interiors or comes with a drink server or something. Who knows?
Yeah.
It sounds great for the alcoholic inside of me. I got to be perfectly honest, because being able to get to and from the bars without having to, you know, drive would be bad for my liver, but good for my enjoyment.
Yeah.
Getting back to the book a little bit, one of the things I found fascinating about the book is you do seem to have the ability to kind of like read and understand people. So like, not only do you kind of know where the market's going, but you, in retrospect, looking back, you're kind of able to understand people. Like you had your aha moment with a Caldwell where he said his hopes, his dreams, grandeur,
yeah,
weakness. You all understood it. Mm-hmm. Do you think this is something you kind of like were able to do at the moment?
Well, I may partially have a gift that I was also always very interested in psychology, and took, while I was getting my degree in business administration, I spent a lot of time over with the behavioral science folks, and found that knowledge of human behavior served me extremely well when it came to my automotive marketing career. So there's some of that. And then don't forget, a lot of it is hindsight. I mean, a lot of this analytical capability, and it occurred to me, like in some cases, you know, 15 or 20 years after the fact, what was actually going on. If I had been like more perceptive when it was actually happening, I probably would have gotten myself into less trouble.
Good point. You do, in the book, you do seem to end up in trouble quite a lot.
Yes. One of my faults, and it always endeared me to the media, but not necessarily to the company I was or my superiors, was I tend to be very outspoken. And that's not always popular.
No, but like you said, us here in the media, we love it. It's nice, too, because, you know, as like a leader, a lot of times you feel like when they're talking with the media, they're feeding you, pardon the phrase, but a lot of shit that's not true. And whenever you've talked to the media or whatnot, I'm sure they didn't get that impression. Very direct and to the point, and it comes across in the book that way.
I think good leaders can take criticism from subordinates, even in an open meeting. I mean, it never bothered me. I always encouraged people to argue with me. And what to me the most distressing thing was when we were having a meeting and I would be the only one talking, and people were furiously scribbling notes. And I said to some of these folks, I said, "Come on, what are you guys doing?" And they said, "Well, you're talking and we're taking notes." And I said, "But not everything I say is true. Argue with, for Pete's sake." Mm-hmm. And they say, "Well, that General Motors, that hasn't exactly been a recipe for success." And I said, "It usually isn't in any company, but I'm really asking you to do it because it's only that." And I said, "Oh, don't worry, I'll tell you when it's enough. And just don't be offended. Don't be afraid." And I said, "You can tell me I'm full of feces." Mm-hmm. But I demand that you preface it by the words, "With all due respect, sir." Yeah. And by George, about a week later, an engineer by the name of Tom Wallace, who was later in charge of Corvette programs, he says, "All right, I'm going to try it." He says, "With all due respect, sir, you are full of," and so forth.
Yeah.
And everybody sat around with mouths and thought, "Oh my God, what's going to happen to poor Tom Wallace?" Well, I congratulate Tom Wallace. I said, "I'm so grateful that somebody finally broke the ice on this." Mm-hmm. And from then on, we had much better meetings. But the tolerance that I have for that is not shared by many senior leaders who feel terribly threatened when they're being challenged in a meeting by a subordinate.
Yeah.
They think it's going to result in anarchy. Whereas it doesn't. I mean, the titular leader always has the last word.
Yeah. Well, you say in the book, and it's a little like off topic, but you talk about when you were in the Marines, and the Marines have that, you know, they're the small underfunded group, and they have to work together, and you know, you may be in charge of someone as an officer, but you're not nearly as valuable to the overall organization as a guy who's like a 20-year grizzled vet. You may technically be in charge of him, but his input is more important than your not. But you always get the last word as a commander, and you just got to appraise it. And I wonder if that's what led you to be able to take, you know, crap and like, not insubordination, but, you know, input from people below you, whereas people who were not in the military, and specifically the Marines, were not. And that's a little off.
People tend to think of the military, and especially the Marine Corps, as highly authoritarian organizations, when in fact they are not. One of the great things, especially about the Marine Corps, is the development of leadership traits in your office. And the Marine Corps is something that no private organization has. It is a monthly publication called the Marine Corps Gazette, in which officers are encouraged to write articles about Marine Corps doctrine, Marine Corps policies, things the Marine Corps should be doing. Those articles can be critical of senior Marine Corps leadership. And that's not considered threatening, and it's not considered insubordinate. In fact, those officers to contribute intelligent thought pieces to the Marine Corps Gazette mm-hmm. are generally considered to be the future leaders.
That's fascinating. Like you said, you don't get that anywhere else. I know we're getting a little short on time. I know you have a hard out. Let me just ask one final question here. What do you think was the biggest factor into why you got into the automotive industry?
The biggest?
Like, what was the
biggest,
moment?
The biggest.
Like, the moment you knew this was what you wanted to do was work in the automotive industry.
Oh, I think about the time I was 3 years old.
Mm.
When, my whole life has been around cars, toy cars, pedal cars, model cars. And anytime I was asked what I wanted to be, I always said, I'd like to be an automotive industry executive. And then during World War II, when there were no cars, it switched over from automotive executive to fighter pilot. And then I was, as stupid at that age, when I was 15, I was disappointed that World War II came to an end, and I felt I had been deprived of my chance to fly fighters and shoot people down, whereas, you know, in reality, I might well have been the shootee as opposed to the shooter.
Yeah.
But I joined right after the Korean War and was military fighter pilot for 9 years, 11 years. So I got my chance. Yeah. And but then once I went to graduate school, the focus was entirely on orienting myself to the automobile industry. There's two other industries I could have been happy in. The aviation industry and the motorcycle industry. All of those would have been.
That's very mechanically minded. Very few people you hear like wanted to be a fighter pilot and, you know, ahead of an industry and actually got the chance and did both. So very.
I consider myself very blessed and very lucky.
Yeah. Very blessed and lucky to have you on the show today, Mr. Bob Lutz.
Oh, thanks for having me. It was fun.
Well, thanks. You're welcome back anytime you want to come back. For those of you listening out there, Bob Lutz, he is the author of Icons and Idiots, Straight Talk on Leadership. I highly recommend you go out and listen to it. Thanks again, sir. Thanks for your service, and thanks for being here with us today.
Thanks very much, Mike.
Thank you. Have a good one, sir.
Yeah, you too. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
All right, again, that was Bob Lutz, Straight Talk on Leadership, Icons and Idiots. We're so lucky to have him here today. Thank you all for listening, and have a good night.